Today is Thursday, April 1st, 2021. It's 1:37 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and you're listening to The Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record every week throughout Chicagoland. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burt from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
I'm Darlene Blanton, a columnist with the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, no fooling, still a columnist with the Chicago Tribune.
You saw the stories about some of the pranks that companies played that they thought would be fun or wacky. Duolingo said they were going to put on toilet paper sheets words and phrases in different languages, which I think is actually a good idea. I'm surprised they're not doing that. Eric, did you have something in mind when you...
Well, I was annoyed with Volkswagen, which earlier this week announced that they were changing their name to Volkswagen, V-O-L-T, because they're switching over to electric cars.
Mm-hmm.
They took it seriously. I mean, they announced it seriously, and then reporters contacted them and said, are you serious about this? They said, yeah, this is not a joke. And then, like Wednesday night, they said, oh, it's just a joke. It was an early April Fool's joke. And this enrages me because I'm not really a big fan of April Fool's Day in general, but there is no such thing as early April Fool's Day.
That's your concern?
That violates every rule. That is just beyond the pale. I was really glad to see the Tribune editorialized against it this morning.
I thought that the violation wasn't that they jumped the gun, but that since they've already kind of been lying to consumers anyway about emissions and things, maybe everybody doesn't appreciate the wackiness of them saying something once again that seemed plausible but wasn't true. I just thought it was a bad corporate kind of idea.
People have made the argument that April Fool's Day, given all the problems we've had with accusations of fake news and lying, it's gone, that event has run its course. We should retire it.
I have canceled April Fool's Day. I have never liked it, but I find it absolutely nails on chalkboard unfunny, given the repeated sort of fake news. And I never understand why journalists participate in it, because our credibility and rests on telling people the truth. And I don't find it funny to tell somebody a lie to trick them and then say, ha ha, you fell for it. And I will admit that I fell for the Volkswagen Bolt wagon.
I did too.
I even told my husband, who's been talking about buying an electric car, because I was like, hey, that's kind of interesting. And then I felt like a world-class chump having to tell him, oh, by the way, that was completely false. And it was an early April Fool's Day joke, which makes zero sense, because if it's a day, then it means it's a 24-hour period.
Right. That's like Christmas on November 19th. No, that's not when Christmas is. Or New Year's Eve is on New Year's Eve. It's not on March 29th. You don't get to do that.
Even on April 1st. I mean, I don't know. I know, especially during the pandemic, I don't sit around and wonder what day of the month it is. And so, I mean, even on April 1st, you have to like say, oh, it's April 1st. I mean, you know,
I got for the same reason. And last year it was canceled. Like, no one did April Fool's last year because nobody was in the mood for that. And I got something this morning from this like libertarian jobs board that totally, they said that they were starting a dating service and it looked so legit. And they were like, so what they said, you'll create a profile where you'll answer critical questions such as, are speed limits constitutional? What is your favorite cryptocurrency? Section 230 immunity. Love it or hate it. And I'm like, wow, this is really, like, we're doomed. This is terrible. But it was a joke.
I was answering those questions in my head and building my profile even as you said them. I mean, that could happen. Okay, enough of that nonsense. I got a lot of pushback on my radio show today. I said the Derek Chauvin trial, I said if it goes wrong, there will be hell to pay in Minneapolis and cities across America, including places like Chicago. And my listeners, some of them said things like, well, wait a minute, what about a fair trial, John, or innocent until proven guilty, or isn't that extortion, John, said another, no favorable verdict and then no safe cities. I understand what their point was, but I watched that video and I don't see how you come to any conclusion other than that isn't murder in the second degree or manslaughter. I'm sure the prosecutors know what they're doing in this case, by the way. But I've been wondering about their strategy so far, too. They are calling witnesses who, however integral to the telling of the story, the narrative of what happened to George Floyd, they're talking about how traumatic his death was to them. And I'm wondering if the jurors will ask themselves what that has to do with the validity of Officer Chauvin's actions. That nine-minute video is horrible to watch, but do they need to tell the story the way they are right now? Is anybody else feeling what I'm feeling about that?
Well, I'm actually feeling the opposite, John, because I do think that, I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the guilt or innocence, and I do think that the trial has to run its course, but it is so hard. I was actually thinking about this morning because I have been crying every day. I mean, I can't get through the trial without bursting into tears. And it's very hard to separate the emotions out of this trial, because even from the beginning, it was an emotional event. And I don't think it's possible for many people to do that, regardless of whether you're African-American or anyone else, if this is something that is important to you. And I think the prosecution is smart because they understand that the jurors are human beings. And when you listen to the evidence in any kind of trial, that evidence has to be processed. And I don't care, you know, I mean, if you're a human being, you're going to process information with the perspective that you take into. That's why they have diverse juries in the first place, because people process information differently. And I think what they're doing is laying the groundwork for people to process this information in a human form that will lead to a guilty verdict.
Well, we're seeing and hearing things that we hadn't previously seen or heard, maybe, but I felt like I'd processed a lot of this already. I mean, I've convicted the guy. So I'm probably a bad judge and jury on this, and probably a bad prosecutor, too. I would just show the 9 minutes of video and then snap my briefcase and say, the state rests, because to me, there's no other conclusion.
So I think it's a strategy from the prosecution, because it seems like the defense, which, of course, we've not seen their case, we've only heard the opening statement. Their argument seems to be that this was proper police procedure, and that if anything went wrong, it was because of the crowd that gathered around George Floyd. And I think that what the defense seems to be doing, and of course, we're only a couple days in, seems to be saying that nobody who witnessed what happened thought it was normal and had just the most severe reaction to what was happening. I was especially struck by the testimony from the firefighter, the paramedic who happened to be there, who said that she was traumatized because she could tell that George Floyd needed medical assistance and she was prevented from rendering aid. And so that's what I think it's designed to do. It's designed to combat that argument of Derek Chauvin followed police procedure. And yes, it was a tragedy, but there was no, you know, murderous intent or negligence. And I think those human responses that we've seen on the stand from people is designed to say, if you were there, that argument just doesn't hold weight. And they've done that over and over again with witness after witness.
Yeah, I was also struck by that firefighter's testimony. And I thought it was interesting that earlier today, the prosecution called Courtney Ross, who was George Floyd's girlfriend prior, you know, in the years leading up to his murder or his homicide, however you would formally want to call it at this point. But and they basically were getting out in front of the issue that he was an opioid addict. And so there were people were questioning, why would they do that? And it's sort of a common trial strategy, as I understand it, which is like, you know, the defense is going to try to paint George Floyd as a drug addict who just died because he was like probably overdosing and also subliminally trying to make people think that maybe he deserved to die because he was a drug addict. There's that. And so they're getting out in front of that. They're basically, you know, bringing it out to the jury saying, hey, yeah, look, this guy had a drug problem. He was, you know, we're not saying that they pulled him out of a choir, out of a pew at church. But that, you know, this was, it still is what it is. And when you watch this video, when you hear from the witnesses and you look at what standard police procedure ought to be in a situation like that, you realize that this was like they're proving the murder charge on him.
I think that at this point that they are doing a great job of pulling at the emotional strings. But when it gets down to any type of medical evidence or anything like that, I mean, I'm looking forward to see how that goes, because that's certainly something the jury is going to have to consider as well. I do want to go back to this opioid thing, because I'm actually going to write about this. We have an opioid crisis in this country, right? Everybody is so concerned about the opioid crisis, but not when it comes to Black men, not when it comes to somebody like George Floyd. How is he different from anybody else? Why can we not have any empathy for him when we're concerned about everybody else who has an opioid problem in this country? And that is the problem I've had with that issue all along. It makes me sick. I can't tell you how it makes me sick that there's a double standard when it comes to African Americans who have drug problems as opposed to everybody else.
That's a really interesting point. And there's a good case to be made that thing, alternative sentencing like drug courts, for example, really only arose as predominantly white, suburban, wealthier families started to see opioid addiction in their own families, dealt with the criminal justice system, and used their political power to demand change in that system, a positive change, but one that only happened after it affected a certain population. I think Heather's point about the Chauvin defense is going to be really important. So I think most people are talking about him using a justification defense, which hinges around this concept of what's reasonable. So under Minnesota law, officers can use reasonable force when they reasonably believe they're effecting a lawful arrest. But, you know, like, what's reasonable, and who's to say what's reasonable? There's a 1989 case, I believe, Supreme Court case, Graham v. Connor, that talks a lot about this, and it basically holds that whether it's reasonable must be evaluated from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene, rather than with like the 20/20 vision in hindsight. And what the defense often does in these cases is they can plead with the jury, you know, don't believe your lying eyes, you know, because you weren't there and you don't have a police officer's training. It's much different. So when they bring witnesses like other law enforcement or paramedics, and they have the same reaction of, oh my gosh, this was insane, totally overstepping, that's very important and very powerful.
I was talking to a friend of mine who's a Black man about 40 years old, and he was almost in tears just in casual conversation about this. And he said, have you ever tried to, just on one knee, hold your body weight for 9 minutes and hold it up just enough so that you don't crush something beneath it? He said, how can you tell me that officer spent 9 minutes with his knee on that man's neck and did not for much of that time bring his full weight on that neck? Thinking about what a reasonable person would do, Austin, how did you not know that you weren't going to strangle or kill this man underneath your body weight? For 9 minutes they were there. In fact, then the thing that maybe just set him over the edge, my friend, as we were talking, was he said, and then when the actual paramedics arrived, they had to tap him on the shoulder to say, okay, now it's, you know, he didn't just get up now that the man's lying there unconscious and the help is here. They still had to ask him to stop doing it.
They asked him and he still wouldn't do it. They actually had to lift him off. And I actually think that that's probably among the most damning testimony against him in this trial. What was he thinking? I mean, I could see why everybody else was telling him to get off, but when the paramedics arrive, he won't even get off. So what is that?
There's not a very flattering way to describe that. So what the defense is going to try to do is they're basically putting George Floyd on trial. You know, people sometimes slip and they say the George Floyd trial, but that's really what happened. It happened in the Laquan McDonald case too, if you remember that, where they basically put Laquan McDonald on trial, saying, "Well, he was a bad guy. He was breaking into cars." It doesn't matter. Laquan McDonald's background doesn't matter. George Floyd's background doesn't matter. His opioid addiction doesn't matter. None of this stuff. What matters is what happened between the time they pulled him out of his SUV and the time he died. That's what matters. I don't think you can make a case that he was that there was a reason to keep kneeling on his neck.
No, there wasn't. But there were times where, as the prosecutions tried to make their own case, you do see George Floyd not being entirely cooperative. That comes up in these kinds of cases all the time. The first gentleman who came upon the scene, that 61-year-old guy, you may have his name at the top of your head. I have it written down here. He counseled Floyd, "You can't win, man."
Is it your voice saying things like "you can't win"?
Yes, ma'am.
And why were you saying that?
Because I have had interaction with officer myself, and I understand once you get in the cup, you can't win. You're done.
Okay.
It's just the way I have looked at it.
So were you trying to just help him to
make the situation easy?
And yet you saw Floyd still struggling with the officers as they were trying to get him in the squad car. It's another instance where if your only concern was to save your own skin, you would have acquiesced, and George Floyd did not seem to be ready or willing to do that. Not by the video that we saw.
Right. Resisting arrest like that is not a capital offense, though.
Nor is passing a fake $20 bill. But there you are. I mean, don't you know that it could go that way? If you're an individual who's being unfairly treated by the police, you don't want to give in. But if you have any opportunity to cooperate with the police, I'm telling you what comes in on my radio show, cooperate with the police.
So I would encourage everybody to read the series that the Washington Post did about George Floyd and his life leading up to that moment in Minneapolis. And I think it makes a relative compelling case that this was a man who had been traumatized at every possible level by the criminal justice system. And I think if you read that series and really think about what he went through, which most likely includes being framed by a Houston police officer, and think about how you would react about being approached by four police officers in a similar circumstance, I think it becomes a little bit more understandable, or you get a better sense of why he did what he did. But there's a significant amount of evidence that shows that he was deeply traumatized by his time in prison, and that he had moved to Minneapolis for a fresh start, but had still been caught up in drug addiction in the criminal justice system. I don't have any problem understanding why he reacted the way that he did. And I think Eric's point that resisting arrest is not a capital crime is a good one. You know, I have to say that Derek Chauvin's behavior really reminds me of the behavior of Jason Van Dyke, who we all know unloaded 16 shots into Laquan McDonald and then was prepared to reload his service weapon before he was stopped by fellow officers. And that whole sort of, "you got to get up now, Officer Chauvin," really sort of brought that all back to me.
Many African-American men in particular feel as though if they're stopped by the police, this could turn, easily escalate to something that could be deadly. And watching the video yesterday, and this was the first time I'd seen this video of the actual arrest when they went to the car to try to get him out. And the way he was pleading with those officers saying, you know, "Please don't do this. I'm not that guy. I'm not a bad guy. I'm not going to do anything to hurt you. Please don't kill me." That was the most, I tell you, I cried for about 10 minutes when I saw that, because you know what it reminded me of? And I know this is going to sound harsh, but this is exactly what I thought about during slavery on the plantations, where slaves had to plead with the slave masters, "Don't beat me. I haven't done anything. I'm sorry. Don't do this." It just reminded me of what the history of this country has been like. And it's almost instinctively it came to George Floyd to react that way. And it's just awful. It was just so painful to watch that.
I got in a cab after the show yesterday, Darlene, and the driver of the cab was a black man, and he was listening to a report about this on the radio. And he and I weren't talking. I could tell that he was paying attention to the radio. And then he just looked into the rearview mirror, and he said, "I don't know what's worse, that he did it or that he's probably going to get away with it."
Well, the closest frame of reference I have is covering the Laquan McDonald scandal. And I can't tell you the number of city officials who told me they expected Jason Van Dyke to be acquitted. Full stop. they were like, look, he's going to be acquitted and it's going to be a terrible situation. They never even truly considered that that jury was going to convict him. And that is because officers, that as Austin was talking about, the officers have a wide range of latitude to act in a way that they believe is reasonable. And it doesn't even have to be reasonable based on the standards of a third party. It's only what they themselves believe is reasonable, which was why everybody at City Hall thought Van Dyke was going to be acquitted, because they're going to say, look, he's going to get up there. He's going to say, I thought I was acting reasonably, and that's going to be the end of it.
Well, if Chauvin were on the stand and they asked him, why did you keep your knee on his neck that long? I wonder what he would say. I wonder what was reasonable about that action.
It seems to me, and again, I haven't been following this. I've been reading the summaries of the testimony for the most part. It seems to me what the prosecution is, or sorry, what the defense is going to try to establish is that he was afraid of what Floyd would do, and he was afraid of the people around the scene.
The crowd wasn't that big, and he was handcuffed.
I'm not saying that it's a legitimate claim, but I'm saying that seems to be from the cross examination stuff that I've read. I had the same. I was not sure that that Van Dyke would be acquitted, but the verdict was kind of, and the verdict actually wasn't that mixed, but the sentence was fairly light, given what happened in that case. Police officers do get a lot of latitude. My guess, if I had to guess right now, would be that they would convict him on one of the lesser charges, but that they will convict him and that he will do prison time. I share the anxieties, the fears of people that if they just acquit him, that we're going to have a replay of last summer. And I would understand that anger completely.
I actually fear if they acquit him if they convict him on one of the lesser charges, we might see the same thing.
Yeah.
People were afraid of that in Chicago after Jason Van Dyke. But, you know, Chicago is kind of a different animal. Folks here don't necessarily get that emotional over some things like that. I think people were just kind of glad to see that he got convicted of something here in Chicago. Because, I mean, there's a reason people don't think it's going to happen, because look at the history. It rarely happens. I mean, police officers are rarely even brought to trial. And when they are, they certainly aren't sent to prison. So I can understand why people don't think this is going to happen.
Well, I'm sure not comparing the two, Darlene, but I would sure hate to see Chicago go through another spring and summer that we went through last year. You know, we just can't have that. I could see us having another episode or two if he's found not guilty of all charges, or maybe just the lesser of the two he's found guilty. I mean, we are so anxious to come back out in the spring and the summer. And I don't mean just to play Frisbee at the park. I'm talking about the economic survival of the downtown. The ramifications across this country of this verdict, I think, are large, don't you?
Absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing. You know, everybody wants to get back outside and have fun. And, you know, people are concerned about that. But I think what people miss is how much this hurts people. I mean, we have seen these witnesses breaking down on the witness stand. They were there and, you know, they saw it. But this is happening all over the country. Like I said, I've been crying every day. Everybody that I know is affected by this. And there was a study done at Harvard a few years ago about how police shootings affect African Americans across the country. Every time a black person is killed by the police, it has this emotional drain on black people, and we carry it with us for months after it happens. It doesn't matter whether you're in the city; it happens to you no matter where you live, and it shows up, and we're sicker. We carry more stress. We stay out of work more. All of these things are how these kinds of things play out with black people. And they compared it to white people, even when a white person is killed by the police. Guess what? Nothing. Nothing among white people when another white person is killed by the police, and nothing in general long term among white people when a black person is killed. But for black people, it is totally different.
I wonder why that is. So, do they say, what's with the lack of empathy among whites?
We personalize it because we know that it could be us. It could be somebody we know. And that tomorrow it might be somebody we know. And so that's why. I mean, it's very personal for us. We get that. And it's a sense of unfairness. It's just, you know, there are so many things that are in the news right now that are just so unfair. I feel like I'm being bombarded with awful things that are happening to minorities across this country. And even when it happens to Asians, I feel it too as an African American. It's just, it's very difficult to be a minority in this country right now.
One last thing for the panel, and then Darlene, I know you are going to go back to watching the trial. Nobody else intervened. I wonder why some of my listeners were theorizing about that. Austin, what was your thought about that? Would there have been a way to persuade Officer Chauvin to release George Floyd?
I can't even think of an example in our cultural memory of a case where that's happened, right?
Yeah.
I would love for one day for a video to go viral of a police officer acting irresponsibly or violently and to be able to be talked off of that behavior by somebody in the crowd. That would be incredible. I'm not saying that's never happened, but I don't think I've ever seen evidence of it happening. So, but yeah, you of course would want to think that if you're presented with a situation like that, that's so clearly unjust, that you would be able to do something about it. The power imbalance is so strong that it's hard to put yourself in those shoes and say that you would do something.
You don't want to get tased. You don't want to interfere with a law enforcement activity. That's against the law. You don't want to get shot. I suppose everybody that was standing there watching this, fearful that this man might die, was also fearful that something bad was going to happen to them too, huh?
Absolutely. And, you know, there will always be bad cops, but there will also always be good cops. And so what we can hope for is that there are also good cops on the scene who will stop the bad cops. And we have seen that happen in the past.
Absolutely. That's true.
Do we know if Chauvin's going to testify? Has there been any suggestion either way?
Yeah, I don't think he has to say until the defense, just before the defense rests their case.
Right. Sometimes in opening statements, a defense attorney will say, and you will hear from my client to the jury. But
you don't want to do too much Perry Mason, Zorn.
Well, no, Van Dyke, Officer Van Dyke ended up testifying. And I think, you know, he really had to because they were trying to make the case that he felt threatened. And I think that Chauvin's only defense here, such as it is that he felt like he had to do this because he had to control this guy who was handcuffed and face down on the ground with a knee on the neck. I don't know how you justify that.
But let's remember, he does not have to prove his innocence. It's the prosecution that has to prove he's guilty. He's under no legal obligation to take the stand, and he's under no sort of legal obligation to explain what he did. And the defense may conclude that they don't have to explain because of that massive amount of latitude that police officers have.
We'll see. I wonder, because yes, you're right. Of course, the presumption of innocence has always got to be there in a trial, but it looks like with the videos that we've seen and the testimony from the onlookers that we've seen, the testimony from the firefighter and so on, that they have made a pretty good case that this was unnecessary, unreasonable use of force that resulted in his death. And I mean, you can't say, well, yeah, okay, so the guy had a drug problem. He wasn't going to die that afternoon because he had a drug problem. They said he had excess adrenaline in his system or whatever because of the arrest. If he had been in the back seat of that police cruiser, he wasn't going to die. What Officer Chauvin did to him resulted in his death. I don't think there's any question about that. So the question is, how do you justify that? And if you can't put him on the stand to justify it, I don't know how you say, well, police procedure allows you to choke somebody to death with your knee because you're afraid he might stand up.
A reporter in the courtroom told me that they've done a really good job of keeping an image or the video in front of the video of that smug, indifferent look on Chauvin's face, and that's powerful. He seems to be so uninterested in that human being underneath him. I mean, talk about unlikable. That's very damning.
You sure is taking a lot of notes. I don't know what that's about. But, you know, I don't think that there's anything he could get on the stand and say that would help him, except for maybe, you know, this is an awful thing that happened, and I'm so sorry it happened. And I'm not sure that would even help him. But And I'm not even sure he's capable of even saying that.
Yeah, maybe he couldn't. Although it looks so bad for him, you almost wonder if a Hail Mary might be worth it. We'll see how the case evolves. But if I had to decide now, I'd say, dude, you're going to go to jail. You might as well get back up there and try and make a case that you thought you were acting reasonably. I sure didn't see in the video any threat of violence in the crowd. I didn't see a mob scene that was about to descend upon him. And by the way, how does keeping your knee on George Floyd's neck, what kind of a strategy is that if you're worried about the mob around you? Maybe you ought to release the guy so that the mob doesn't descend upon you after you kill him. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Darlene, I know you're going to go back to watching the trial. You wrote about this in the Chicago Tribune. They couldn't save him, but testimony speaks for George Floyd. It's a fascinating column in the Tribune. We enjoy reading you, and we appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and come back, Darlene. It's always good to
have
your perspective.
I will. Okay, great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. We invite her all the time, Eric, but you know what this podcast pays, and so sometimes people have to do their paying gig and not just hang out with us for a little bit.
I don't like those priorities, but...
Today, by the way, is day one of the 2021 Major League Baseball season, even as one MLB game is postponed today due to COVID-19. Still, fans are heading back to the parks and the diners, and the drinkers are going to the restaurants and bars, and there's a spring in our economic step. In fact, listen to this. Money manager Dr. Bob Frelick made so much money in markets and other financial endeavors, he bought the Kane County Cougars and other things. And 1 year ago, Frelick said that today, on the opening day of Major League Baseball's new season,
presidential and congressional election, throwing so much money at the problem and this big money rebalancing, you add those all together, the Dow Jones Industrial Average will close above 30,000 this year. And furthermore, it'll cross 33,333 before Major League Baseball's opening day in 2021.
And but for a couple of hundred points, he was right. At a time when we didn't know if or when we would ever get out, he was pretty bullish on the U.S. economy and the markets. So we invited him back this week, and he said that the Dow will close this year above
40,000 by the end of the year. So when we get to the end of the year, my actual forecast, so everyone can remember it, is 401k, just like your retirement account. So 40,100, clear another 20% in the market from here. So, I mean, the best is not behind us. The best is in front of us.
41,000. He's bullish on everything except commercial real estate. And he said, we are not going back to the offices. He said, people like working in their sweatpants and they're not going back. I'm not sure about that, but that pessimism about the return to downtowns was also echoed in a New York Times article this week that said about 90% of Manhattan office workers are working remotely, a rate that has remained unchanged for months. And then they wrote about what that means, what the consequences of that could be. I'm shocked to see that it's as high as 90%. I don't know what it is in Chicago. Eric, I want to start with you and the notion that we're never coming back into the loop.
I think what we're going to see is a much increased use of this hybrid model where you're basically at home or you're at home 3 days a week and you go to the office 2 days a week. I believe what's going to happen with the Tribune, for instance, with my department, is that we're going to probably go to the Freedom Center building once a week and we'll have a meeting there, maybe work there one day a week, and then the rest of the time we'll be at home. You know, my son, who does work in Manhattan, was just visiting us for 2 weeks, and he just took up residence in my office. He had he's in finance. He had a whole set of screens that he had with him, and he was all set up, and he was able to do his work just fine. And I think that people are going to find that they're going to save a lot of time commuting and a lot of time in dress clothes and everything else, and that managers have found in the last year that employees can do really good work and be very productive when they're not in the office.
Well, first of all, I like dress clothes.
There's I believe it's 5 Willis Towers worth of empty office space in downtown Chicago right now, which is up, I think, 3 or 4 percentage points from the previous year. I think it will permanently alter the landscape of downtown Chicago. It's definitely a buyer's market. Illinois Policy just changed offices, and we got about 50 million more perks than before for cheaper than we were paying.
Really?
And it's one thing I thought about a lot when we were writing the New Chicago Way, the book about the city, and a line that we put in there was basically, successes often stumble, but problems seldom do. And I am remembering quotes from people like Madigan spokesperson Steve Brown when confronted with, hey, Illinois has a problem with people leaving, has a problem with economic growth relative to other states. And he says, well, then why am I seeing all of these cranes in downtown Chicago? If everything's so sickly and anemic, why are people investing downtown? Well, of course, like, there are still extremely valuable pieces of land and opportunities for money to be made, making the right investment. But that success has certainly stumbled a lot. And it would be a very risky bet to be building or investing in downtown real estate right now, given the changing nature of that investment.
Right, and you're going to see restaurants that serve primarily lunchtime clientele. Those restaurants are going to be in trouble. Some of these parking facilities aren't going to be making the money that they were making.
Yeah.
And there was talk in one of the articles about maybe that they'll work on hologram technology so that you can,
yeah,
you can port yourself into meetings as a hologram.
So. What what a stupid idea. I don't know. What do you think of that, Eric?
Do you guys remember when Will.i.am was on CNN as a hologram?
Yes.
That was the best.
I was just going to say that's the first time I saw it, and then it seemed superfluous. And the idea now, listen, nobody loves Zoom, right? But I guess we could hologram me into the meeting. It's still a frickin' meeting. You're still not here. I mean, really? That helps.
I've gotten really used to Zoom meetings. We have Zoom meetings a couple times a week in the opinion section, and I managed to mentally be there with my colleagues. At first it was a difficult transition, but now I'm so used to it that it doesn't seem at all weird.
But do you like your life better this way, Eric?
No, but I do like. I would like to go in once a week or so, at least, to see people face to face, because the kind of conversations you have on Zoom are not the kind that you have just in the office, and I do miss those, and I'm really looking forward to those returning. But in terms of, you know, not commuting, and I kind of like that. I'm getting
really
used to it.
Really,
yeah.
I mean, I know you are. But I also think you are a little more. You've been a lot more conservative about the virus than me. Say, I don't think you would be as eager to get out of your place as I have been to get out of mine.
I'm very eager to resume a lot of normal activities, but I'm willing to be cautious about things like riding the L, and that's one thing that I'm amazed that you ride the L in most of the time, right, John?
Well, after just missing getting mugged about 3 times in 2 weeks, I took to the bus. So now I take the bus every day. Much better. Man, I love the bus. You know, did you guys see what Mary Sue Barrett, the president of the Chicago Metropolitan Planning Commission, said? In order to encourage people to come back downtown, we should make all public transportation free for a while. Pace, Metro, even Metro, but the CTA too. And I told her, I says, I don't think it's the cost, although that might help. I think it's people don't want to get mugged or catch COVID, sure. But for me, on the CTA, on that red line, I think it's a safety issue. She said, yeah, no, that's not it. I think she's completely wrong about that.
I think it's really hard to know what life is going to look like a year from now, or even 6 months from now, because a year ago in March, we had just sort of begun this whole thing and didn't know there were going to be vaccines, didn't know that they would be as safe and effective as they are. So it's really hard for me to sort of think 6 months or a year ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the city council is supposed to be meeting in person for the first time in more than a year in April. And I think once that happens, if it happens, given the surge that we're in now, I think will give me a better sense of how it's all going to work and sort of what I'll feel comfortable doing. But I think that we may be underestimating people's desire once they're fully vaccinated to put this all behind them and sort of leave Zoom behind and only value in-person communications. And I think that once that sort of reaches a tipping point, I think you're going to see the CTA return to more or less normal, or what it was, let's say, in February 2020. I feel like we're talking about, like, you know, a space alien, you know, like, what do you think when we have jetpacks? What will that be like? If you think about sort of the culture of the 1920s, of course, after the big flu pandemic of 1918, was that pandemic response did not have a huge cultural shift on what people did. And if it had an impact, it made people sort of more willing to go out, more sort of emphasis on partying and having fun and spending money and sort of, you know, living for the moment. So I think it's a little bit of a fool's errand to try to figure out how we're all going to come out truly on the other side of this, because we are still very much in the thick of it.
The difference between the 20s, obviously, now one of them is the nature of work. And I think to Eric's point, that hybrid, people are going to be demanding, maybe not being totally remote all the time, but I don't know a single person working in a job that could be done remotely where them or their coworkers is requesting to be in the office fewer days a week. And I think that will become the norm. I think ridership on those on public transit will be substantially down for that reason, just with commuters. There will not be as many people commuting downtown on a given day, given these new work structures. So you could make it, you could pay people to take the train, and I don't think you'd get back to that original ridership. Metro's had reduced fares for a long time, mm-hmm. and their ridership's still in the toilet.
But Austin, you said you don't know anybody who would want to go back to the office?
No, everyone who I know has a job that can be done remotely or works in a workplace of that setting. Either they or their coworkers, when things get back to normal, are requesting that they're in the office fewer days a week, right? Yeah. They're not going back full time.
Well, Heather, will your job be changing too? I mean, you're in television, so you've got to be.
I started at WTTW almost a year ago exactly, so I don't have a desk in the newsroom. So people were like, "Oh, we should, you know, be sure you have a desk so you when you come back." It's a little bit sad. Today's, you know, opening day for the Cubs. Usually we'd have the game on in the press room, and Fran Spielman and Bill Cameron would be yelling epithets or cheering. So I miss that.
But, you know, imagine if you were a new employee at Channel 11. That is, if they didn't know, but if they'd never met you before.
Yeah, it would be tough.
They would not know who this person is. And I would be a little anxious if I was an employee and hadn't met my immediate supervisors in person more often or my colleagues. I think all of us have been in our positions long enough. People know who we are, but you want to build a certain esprit de corps if you're a business. And you can't do that when everybody's working in their gym jams from home.
the Tribune had an article not too long ago about how television news has changed.
Yeah.
That they realize that they can get people more quickly if they do things like this, like Zoom or Skype, and that before there was a great resistance to that, and now that they've been forced into it, that they've been able to be a lot more nimble in terms of what they can put on, who they can put on, and so that's changing. And I'm guessing that in some way some of our news gathering is going to change. Certainly we've had at the Tribune, we've had interviews with newsmakers where they would usually come into the office, we'd sit around a table. Well, now they come in by Zoom, and we do these group Zoom interviews. And I can see a lot of times where we're going to be able to take some things that we've learned here about what we can do, what our capabilities are, what technology allows us to do that we had resisted before, and we'll be able to improve our product, to improve our performance.
And I think that's on the viewers and listeners' perspective too, right? Like the consumers of media are now used to podcasts that don't sound perfect audio quality wise because we're all talking to different kinds of devices in our homes and it's not uniform, and a podcast doesn't sound, or a radio interview doesn't sound like it normally would because we're not all using the same quality mics. And on TV, when you're watching the news, you're absolutely right. You're sort of used to watching the weather person from their living room, and you kind of shrug. You don't even think twice about it now.
We've sort of talked about continuing to do Zoom interviews.
Yeah, you could.
Yeah, even when everything's normal, because especially like with somebody like, you know, a senator who's stuck in Washington, before it was, well, I guess we just can't have them on the show. Well, now we can. And if it makes sense journalistically to have them on the show, we've got now more tools in our toolbox, essentially.
Yes, I'm trying to think who there's a downstate U.S. congressman that you guys have been having on fairly often, and I'm blanking on his name right now, but it's someone who you would probably not have had before. He'll be in a panel discussion with some local Congress people, and just have, and it's good because some of these downstate people have a different perspective than Chicago or suburban lawmakers who you can't get on. So I think there's a lot of good things that can come out of this.
I was thinking about the difference between upstate and downstate this week. A lot of my listeners are driving to Carbondale because you can walk into the Civic Center on campus at Southern Illinois University and get the J&J. And we talked about that last week. A lot of them are reporting back to me saying that's going so well. When you travel from Chicago to Carbondale, you go through three different states, and Jackson County and Cook County could be completely different planets. And I know there's a lot of animosity between upstate and downstate, and they don't want to have anything to do with Cook County except that we pay their bills. And I'm thinking, well, imagine the task of being the governor and coming up with meaningful policies for something as big and convoluted as Illinois. Eric, you also, I was just wondering how things are going at the Tribune and how you as an employee of the Tribune feel about the possibility that maybe Alden Global Capital is not going to be your evil overlord. What's the latest on that?
Well, the very latest is that we now have the first news that came out was that this guy, Weiss, I think his name is Hans-Jörg Weiss, the Swiss billionaire, was going to partner with the guy, Stuart Bynum from Baltimore, who's attempting to buy out the Baltimore papers the Maryland papers from Alden. And so just to refresh everyone's memory, Alden Global Capital is this hedge fund that's seeking to buy Tribune Publishing and all the newspapers that are associated with it. And they are known for essentially just ripping them apart and selling them for parts. And so the guy, Stuart Bynum in Maryland, decided he was going to try to save the Maryland papers from the clutches of Alden. And then this guy, Hans-Jörg Weiss, the Swiss billionaire, came along and said, well, he was going to buy some other papers. And then Mason Slain, who's a Tribune shareholder, said he wanted to help acquire the Florida titles. And now there's a Gary Luton, a banker. He wants to preserve maybe the Pennsylvania papers. And so there is this possibility that you're going to get this critical mass of millionaires and billionaires who are going to get in and bid up the price and buy out Alden and save these local newspapers, including the Tribune. It's not I'm always gloomy about these things because the way these deals work is often a little mysterious, and the levers of power are held by people whose motives are not necessarily clear. But this is the first real glimmer of hope we've had in a really long time that maybe we're not going to be essentially, torn apart by Alden Global Capital. And they're known for really decimating staffs and limiting coverage. So a lot of us have been very depressed about it. And this is the first glimmer of hope we've had in a long time.
What would the purchase price be? What's the value of the Tribune?
Gosh, I'm thinking it's up in the $600-700 million range. Heather would probably know.
I do not know.
Heather doesn't have a – wait. There's a problem with your microphone.
I think it was $600 million, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Valuation somewhere around there.
Something like that. Of course, when they bid up the price, the overall cost goes up. The guy from Switzerland, Weiss, I want to say, maybe it's Weiss.
That's W-Y-S-S, right? Is that how he's...
Right, yeah. Anyway, he said a lot of
The Chicago pronunciation is, Weiss.
He's Weiss.
He's a Weiss guy. that he was saying a lot of good things about that he believes you can invest in local newspapers and that they can make money. And that and he believes in the basic idea of local journalism. And I guess he's saying all the right things. And so I think that we have right now, like I say, a glimmer of hope, and we'll take it.
And this is where I remind everybody that billionaire ownership is not a panacea for news organization ownership. I'm happy to display my scars from the end of DNA Info Chicago, because if you rely on a single person to salvage your operation is then dependent on the whims of that person, regardless of whether they are well-intentioned or not well-intentioned.
And I will show you my scars from the Sam Zell years at the Tribune. So you're absolutely right. But the alternative at this time, is this hedge fund with a terrible track record. So we know what we're getting with them. So this is this alternative. Yes, you're right. You never know. This guy may come in and go, you know, what I really think is, you know, we got to get rid of the columnists. That's what we got to get rid of. That's what I mean by making a local newspaper better. So, you don't know. You don't know what
the the same day that your newspaper reported a little bit on this, they also had the story about how the classical music writing in the Tribune is going to be underwritten by a fund at Oberlin College so that somebody else is going to pay for the reporter, if I'm reading it correctly, who will write about classical music. And the Tribune, said that they would editorially control the content and the assignments, but that somebody else would pay for it. And I think that's a, hey, listen, if that works, great, but it is a slippery slope, isn't it? Because what if this person starts to pan the CSO and the people that are underwriting it, who are really looking for promotion of classical music, don't like that? Does that taint the reporting or the integrity of the reporting, you know? And if you write honestly enough, do they pull the funding? So it's kind of a funny setup, but maybe one, who knows, Eric, maybe that'll work.
Well, the Sun-Times has been doing that with coverage of women's basketball. It's sponsored by, I want to say, University of Chicago Health Systems, maybe. And so it's kind of like an endowed charity university. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? And you're absolutely right to point to the potential ethical problems, and it's why you haven't seen this happen throughout American journalism. It is a slippery slope. It's a difficult situation. I think the what we were facing, though, is that we weren't going to have a classical music critic. We couldn't afford a classical music critic unless it was underwritten like this.
And, yeah.
And it, we're hoping, and we hope the readers trust in our editors and in this journalist to call it like she sees it, and for the stories to run as they are. And if Oberlin College decides that they don't like our coverage and yanks the funding, then we'll be willing to live with that. I trust my immediate editors, the people who I work for in our newsroom, to have that kind of integrity, and I hope that the readers trust that too.
Our arts coverage is underwritten by a foundation under the exact same model, and we've had no ethical constraints, it just is sort of the wave of the future. And I think that, I would not be surprised to see more news organizations go wholly nonprofit, because I think that's a sustainable way to do this work without being beholden to one whimsical billionaire. And you can sort of do sort of a hybrid model where you get foundation grants and underwriting and that sort of thing, but also charge, reasonable subscription rates. Because I think people also will support things that they find valuable, and that's got to be part of the way forward.
Yeah, and radio's done this for years, right, yeah. John? I mean, in terms of, you would have your Allstate Showcase studio and so on. And nobody
yeah, we do.
I don't think anyone thinks like, well, I can't trust WGN because Allstate sponsors their studio, So anyway, newspapers are a little late to the game, if anything.
I like the idea. I still like the idea of pay-per-click, charge micro pennies for micro cents for each time you click. Every now and then I want to get a story from the Boston Globe. I want to get a story from Denver or Seattle. I don't subscribe to those papers regularly. They say you've reached your limit. Some of them it's a very short limit. Some of them I can't even get to at all. What they say is to read this story. This happens on Newsweek too. To get some content, you have to subscribe, and some is free. Okay, well, I'm sorry, Newsweek. I'm not going to subscribe, so I guess I don't read the article. I don't want to subscribe for a year. I don't even trust the subscription models because it seems like they get my credit card and they know I'm going to forget that I subscribed, and then they're just going to run the register on me. But I would pay you to read that story. I would pay you a nickel or a fifth of a cent. And I think if you had millions of people all contributing very small amounts per view, and by the way, everybody's stealing from you with these free views anyway, why don't you just charge a very reasonable, tiny amount? It would require some sort of magazines or newspapers.
Order of sorts.
Yeah. But I'm all for it. Don't you like it, Austin? No?
I was thinking about your idea the other day because there's a YouTube competitor called Odyssey. It's spelled in like a punny way, Odysee. And it's all hosted on the blockchain. And so creators directly monetize their videos. So similar to YouTube, where you get views and you earn money on those views because YouTube runs ads around your content. This is more directly between the creator and the viewer. So they automatically trade this currency. The problem is that the SEC, I believe, filed a lawsuit against them for securities fraud 2 days ago. And what will be a very big case for whether cryptocurrency is a currency or a security.
Wow.
That's a big question.
The whole notion of micropayments where like you can pay like the Denver Post, you know, a dime to read one story. It has been the holy grail of online digital journalism since I took my very first news and new media class back in 19... 19- at Northwestern, and nobody has ever been able to make it work in a way that is sustainable and that people will trust. Because John, I think you're right. You feel like you give your credit card information over to you know, a nameless, faceless corporation, and you never see it again. But you know, everybody I have spoken to about these issues is that that's the ultimate solution for online sort of solvency, but nobody knows how to do it.
Can you just catch us up a little bit on a story that we were talking about before we began today? And that is what you and Austin were describing as the Chicago Police Department's use of flawed gang data. What are you guys talking about? What's upsetting about this?
So 2 years ago, Inspector General Joe Ferguson completed an audit of what the city calls its gang database, but which is actually, it was 18 different databases that they use to track people that they either come in contact with or arrest or have some sort of interaction with as gang members. Now, the idea is that Chicago has a law enforcement interest in knowing who's a member of what gang. But the problem with this database was that it contained approximately 135,000 names. 95% of those were Black and Latino Chicagoans, so it was racially disproportionate. And it was also riddled with errors. There were dozens of people who were listed in the database who would have been more than 100 years old. There were dozens of people in the database who were younger than 10 years old. And it wasn't clear what sort of law enforcement purpose it served. The Inspector General also found that if you were listed in the database, you also faced a lot of consequences. You could face deportation under the Trump administration. You could have trouble passing a background check for a job. You couldn't get a professional license if you wanted to start a business. So the Inspector General said, look, Chicago police, you got to stop this. You got to figure out a new way to do that. Do this if you think it's worth having. And at the time, Lori Lightfoot was running for mayor, and she said, right, yes, I totally agree with you, Joe Ferguson. Well, it's now 2 years later. The same database exists. The Chicago Police Department is still using that flawed, erroneous data, which is ripe for abuse. And they've basically done nothing significant to create a new way of tracking who's in a gang and who's in not a gang. And the Inspector General's audit was just absolutely scathing that they've allowed this sort of to linger for so long.
It's another case, I think, of extraordinary lack of professional management in the police department. It obviously comes from the top. Like, these things aren't going to get done if the mayor doesn't make them a priority. It's kind of the system that we live in currently. The mayor put in place someone who had experience managing this in Los Angeles with a department of 200 to 300 people whose entire role was to monitor and reform the police department. And that was Charlie Beck, who did that in Los Angeles. And Charlie Beck's tenure ended. And by all accounts that I've heard, any effort at doing any of that work has really stalled since the new superintendent has come into town. And that's a personnel issue. It's also a leadership issue from the mayor. And it speaks to, not only with this, but with the consent decree, why you need a police commission dedicated to just doing these basic management things. If I owned a chain of restaurants and I had a bunch of managers that were doing a bunch of stuff and things were falling through the cracks, you have to have a plan to get those people to change their behavior to make the business better. It works the same way in management and government. You have a vision of where you want to go. You have steps you need to take, and you need to have people accountable for making those changes, but none of the changes are happening.
This whole process was complicated by the fact that the city had been sued by several people who were listed in the database who said that they had faced serious consequences of that. And it took the city a long time to settle that lawsuit, which basically says we will take these, you know, steps to collect correct information. We will give people a chance, if they're listed in the database, to appeal that designation and to, you know, offer proof that they're not in a gang. That agreement also requires the city to take the information that it now has in large part and basically wall it off and say, you are no longer allowed to use this information for law enforcement purposes. And that hasn't happened yet, which is, I think, a significant area of concern, because if the city is admitted in court, we understand that this data is flawed and is not reliable, yet we're making law enforcement decisions based on it. I think it puts the city in an awkward position. Morally, if not legally, because I don't even play a lawyer on the radio.
But what do they do with this information, Heather? I mean, what's the harm in having a database that isn't perfect, but at least it kind of tells you what the potential universe is of these guys?
Right. And I think that's what the mayor favors. The problem is that for decades, the police department was allowed to basically list anybody they felt like listing in this database, potentially at huge costs for especially undocumented immigrants. So the issue is, we can't just let them use their best judgment, because that's gotten us into this situation in the first place. So what rules are going to be in place? What triggers being added to the database? What are sort of the things that have to happen if there's a mistake? What's the appeal process? So that all has to be laid out. Now, there are certainly people who say that the city should not have this database, that the database is going, there's no way for it to operate appropriately, that it will always be ripe for abuse, that it will always be used disproportionately against Black and Latino Chicagoans. Frankly, I think the inspector general has made some of those arguments for people, because he says Chicago's gangs today are very different than the way they were 20 years ago, where there were several big gangs that you could sort of track the leadership of and say, okay, well, you know, this is the leader of the Gangster Disciples and this is the leader of the Latin Kings. Chicago's gangs don't really operate that way anymore. They're much more fragmented. They have a smaller territory and they have more parochial interests. So the inspector general's question is, hey, police department, have you thought about whether this sort of database makes sense in this era of Chicago gangs as we find ourselves? That's a question that the police department has so far declined to grapple with, and I think it's one that they should eventually.
Well, is it maybe we don't need this database anymore because it's so fluid and fractured?
Right, right. And if you've got, instead of 15 gangs in Chicago, you have, you know, 30 gangs that are a fraction of the size, you know, with all sorts of changing allegiances, does an overall database serve any legitimate law enforcement purpose? I don't know the answer to that question, but that is a question. The other issue is would that law enforcement benefit outweigh any damage to somebody who might be inadvertently caught in it and then prevented from renting an apartment or getting a job?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because as you talk about this, I know that's not what I was originally worried about. I was just worried about the efficacy of the data. And if it's not perfect, say LaVie, but maybe it's actually injurious to somebody. Austin, should we just not even have a database like this?
Heather makes a good point about what the inspector general's report found. And obviously, when you have these hard and fat, like a no-fly list, obviously, has been, you know, really a horrible policy for a lot of people in the United States. If you get on that list, it's impossible to get out, and your experience traveling throughout the country legally and internationally is a nightmare. Now, the on the ground effects of having a gang database are a little bit different than that, as we've just talked about. So it's not clear to me whether, of course, you need to collect information about criminals in the city and their connections to other people that helps you solve crimes. That's very important. But the bigger problem is that regardless of whether you think we should have a gang database or should not, there are these huge structural problems with the way it's been operating, and just no one does anything about it for 2 years, and including the mayor who ran, at least in part, on fixing it. And that's a huge problem, and speaks to just lack of any professional management in that department and throughout city government.
It's a little reminiscent of the story we just saw lately with a guy who has the same name as a guy downstate who is wanted on a warrant.
Yeah.
And he's been hauled into the police station over and over
again. 60 times or something.
Yeah, it was just incredible. And I guess finally with the publicity and the lawsuit, the police department's finally getting around to adjusting their records. But yeah, the mandate here, I think, is to make these records accurate and current. It's very difficult to do, but without that, you have these injustices that occur. I'm a little disappointed to hear Heather downplaying the danger of the insane centenarians in the database. That those old people can be really rough.
Yeah, just because they're 100 doesn't mean they're not trouble, Heather. By the way, as we speak here, the Chicago Cubs have started their first game. Does anybody have a score on where the Cubs are? Eric, do you have that on your third screen over there by any chance?
I had it about half hour ago, so no.
They're down 3-2 in the top of the fourth.
There's a St. Louis Cardinals fan, ladies and gentlemen. What's that hat you're wearing, though?
Well, it's my Cardinals hat. Okay, it's a Sunday home hat.
Who's going to win more games this year, by the way? The White Sox by 15 games, right? Is that a safe bet?
Hope so. I'm all in with the White Sox.
I know. Last year you gave up on the Cubs, and you know, if you're going to go with the White Sox, you got to stay with the White Sox now, although that'll be a very safe place to be if you're just looking for a winner. But you need to feel it in your heart, Eric. It needs to be more than I don't like the Cubs. It needs to be I want to be part of Sox Nation. Are you that?
It's been a transition for me. It's been a couple of years I've been working on this, moving on. I mean, it's the Ricketts family, it's their marquee network, it's the whole thing. And also the fact that you can go to a Sox game, you can just pull up and buy a ticket and get a good seat. And so, and they look like a promising team. They're rebuilding. I guess Jimenez had an injury, and it's going to be a bit of a problem this year, but I think that the team is going to be worth following. And
Aloy ran into the wall, leaped up, tried to catch a ball in left field during a spring training game.
Way over his head.
Had no chance of getting it, but you know, because hey, he's a kid and he's just playing ball, and so he reaches up and pretends like he's going to catch it, and then kind of hangs there to rest his weight, and then wrenches his tendon, and he's out for 5 to 6 months. And he is a sensational player, but they have enough that while he'll be missed, it's probably not going to. The experts today said it wasn't going to cost him many games. They've got a lot of other good players on that team. It's going to be fun. I hope we get in 162 games for each team, you know, and then who cares if we win or lose. Okay, guys. Eric Zorn, thanks for joining us today. Austin, appreciate your time. Heather Sharone, we also appreciate Darlene Glanton checking in on the Mincing Rascals. We're produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Thanks, everyone. That was fun.
Bye.
Bye.
See you next week.
Bye. Later.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.